so I think we'll get started. I'm Rob Lindemann from Computer Science Department and from the Interactive Media and Game Development Program. And I'd like to welcome you all to a double dipping of a CS Colloquium and Speaker Series talk. Our speaker today is Ava Hudlitska, and she is a principal scientist and president at Psychometrics Associates in Blacksburg, Virginia. Her primary research focus is on development of computational models of emotion aimed at enhancing our understanding of the mechanisms underlying cognition-emotion interaction. She received her BS in biochemistry from Virginia Tech, her Master of Science in computer science from The Ohio State University, and her PhD in computer science down the road at UMass Amherst. We're really excited because this is a talk that spans both computer science and IMGD, and so we hope to have a lot of interaction, and I'll get out of the way now and let Ava talk.
Thank you. I was talking to Rob about what to do about questions, and so it's always a toss-up whether to allow questions because I have, as usual, way too many slides. But I would like to encourage you to ask questions during the talk, and if I get too far behind, then I may change that policy. So what I'd like to do is just tell you about how, by adding emotion, we could make games more interesting and more interactive. And I'm not going to be showing any games here, but what I'll do is I'll be telling you about how you can actually model emotion in agent architectures that will then allow you to embed those architectures in game characters. So I'll tell you a little bit about affective gaming, a little bit of background on emotion research from psychology, because it's very important to be familiar. Where are we now with respect to gaming? Well, there have been obviously tremendous advances in gaming technologies, as we can see, but primarily they've been focused on the physical realism of the game characters and the environments, and then, of course, the complexity on the, you know, the performance issues and the network infrastructure and all that. But the games are still limited in what the affective realism. So the affective realism of the game characters, the social realism of their behavior, the social complexity of their behavior, what kind of emotions can they recognize, what kind of emotions can they display in situations, the narrative complexity of the games, and the player modeling, of course, and which influences how well the game can adapt to the player state. So there's still a lot of room for improvement in game realism. And so in terms of the sort of full potential of gaming, this is kind of where I think we are without making games much more affectively and socially realistic and engaging. So to achieve the next big leap, games would greatly benefit from adding more emotion. And that means adapting to the player's affective states. And that's actually the focus of a lot of the current affective gaming research. But also enhancing the social and the affective complexity of the game characters themselves. And that's not being done as much. Most of the emphasis in affective gaming is here. And so basically we want to enhance the affective realism of their characters, which is going to allow us to make more complex social interaction, more affectively realistic interaction among the characters and also between the characters and the players. And also enhance the game narrative as a whole, because, you know, if you're comparing a current first-person shooter with Shakespeare, you know, there's quite a bit of leap there. So it'd be nice if we could kind of approach that kind of narrative complexity. And there's a nice quote by some of affective gaming researchers in terms of progression of games, the complexity of games. So assist me, challenge me, and emote me. So the idea is to really get the player involved emotionally, and not just in terms of arousal, but in terms of some of the more subtle emotions. Okay, so emotions are key factors in both play and work. They play a central role in engagement. They are important in learning. If we're feeling happy, we're more likely to learn than if we're feeling stressed or frustrated or bored or what have you. They influence decision making and problem solving. There's lots of research on that that's very relevant to, especially to serious games. They facilitate communication and development of relationships. So especially if we start thinking in terms of games and say relational agents and maybe plugging in some relational agents, then again emotions become very critical. And they're, of course, a key factor in serious games, and whether these are games for learning or games that are sort of therapeutic or rehab games or what have you. Okay, so a little bit of background on emotion research. So what are emotions? We could sort of spend the next 6 years debating that, but I'll just reduce that to one slide that's relevant for modeling emotions in games. You can think of them as evaluative judgments of the world, of others, and of yourself in light of the agent's current goals and beliefs. And that's critical, because emotions arise when there's some kind of self-relevance. If you don't care about something, you're not likely to have an emotion about it. And once they're generated, they motivate behavior, of course, and they influence decision-making, they influence perception, problem-solving, and they also help coordinate adaptive behavior. So it's kind of they're a bunch of subroutines, if you want to think about it that way, for doing efficient behaviors. That's kind of the one way to think about them. So some of the roles of emotions, it's useful to divide them into two classes, the interpersonal and the intrapsychic. So on the interpersonal side, emotions coordinate social communication, social coordination in groups, in dyads, in any kind of social groups. And they do this by communicating behavioral intent, so that way you know what the other person's likely to do, and it helps you manage the interaction. And they do that through facial expression, through various kinds of ways we have of expressing emotion. Facial expression, speech, both the content and the qualities of speech, gesture, posture, and of course specific actions that you would be choosing to do. They also play an important role in motivation, in homeostasis, and of course in adaptive behavior. And they do that through their various kinds of theories about what emotions are, so we can think of them as a global interrupt system. You're doing something, all of a sudden some other stimulus comes in that kind of redirects your attention to something that's more important. So all of a sudden you have to rearrange your goals, restructure your goal hierarchy, and prepare for the action that needs to take place. And a useful way to think about it from a modeling point of view is that you can think of these two separate underlying processes. Emotion generation on the one hand, you first have to go from the stimulus to the emotion, and then once the emotion is generated, it exerts a certain kind of effect. And I'm going to come back to that when I talk about modeling. So how do we recognize an emotion if we see one? Emotions are complex, multimodal phenomena. And so there are a lot of debates in the past have talked about, is emotion a feeling or a thought? Well, it's both, and it's a lot more than that. So it's a set of complex, coordinated processes, and it has, here's sort of the four modalities that are typically emphasized. The somatic physiological, so that's your arousal, your heart rate, your GSR. The cognitive interpretive processes, that's kind of the extreme of that, is that nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And these are the ones that are typically used in agent architectures to generate emotions. You're not going to be generating emotions from physiology because our agents don't have any physiology. So this is kind of the emphasis in emotion modeling. And, of course, the behavioral and motivational manifestations. And then there's the experiential sort of subjective manifestation, which we're also not going to worry about. So the ones that are highlighted are the modalities of emotion that we focus on in affective modeling. Okay, so let's first talk about how emotions are generated. So you start out with some set of stimuli, you have some kind of an appraisal process, and outcome emotions. And the stimuli can be either perceived, this is how we typically think of it, but they can also be recalled. I'm sure you've all had the experience where you remember something and you get happy or sad or mad or what have you. And they can also be imagined. So you can have a situation where you're anxious about something, and the more you think about it, the more anxious you get. So here's a stimulus that I'm guessing most of us will have an affective reaction to one way or the other. And what's interesting about emotions is that the same stimulus can trigger very different affective reactions depending on lots of different things, your beliefs, your goals. So while some people might have this reaction, other people might have this reaction. And of course, which one you have depends on your goals, your desires, your values, your standards for behavior, your beliefs about what this, you know, who these folks are and what they're likely to do, your expectations, etc. And the emotion generation process is also influenced by your existing emotion, your existing mood, your personality trait. So it's a very individual idiosyncratic process, and it's very important that we capture that process when we're modeling emotion in game characters to make them more interesting and more reactive, so that, you know, say given the same situation, if your character's in a good mood, one time he's going to react in one way, but if he's in a bad mood, another time he's going to react a different way, and it's just going to make the game that much more engaging. Okay, so what does an emotion do once it's been generated? So I'd like to divide this into two categories of effects. Emotions have a profound influence on cognition, and if you think of the affective and the cognitive systems as functioning in sort of a coordinated, coupled manner, tightly coordinated, coupled manner, with lots of complex feedback processes among them. So there are a lot of interactions back and forth. Emotions influence the fundamental processes that mediate high-level cognitive processing. So that means attention and working memory, both the speed of those processes and the capacity of those processes, and also the long-term memory. And that's true for both recall and encoding. So in other words, if you're, for example, there's a phenomenon called the mood congruent recall, that if you're in a good mood, you're likely to remember positive events, and if you're in a bad mood, you're likely to remember negative events. So there are a lot of influences on long-term memory. There are a lot of specific affective biases on specific processes. So for example, anxiety causes attentional narrowing. It causes a threat bias. So if you're in an anxious state and you're presented with a bunch of stimuli, you're more likely to pick up the threatening stimuli and ignore the non-threatening stimuli. And we'll come back to that in a gaming example in a minute. It also has a self-focus bias, that you're more likely to be focused on your own state, which is going to make you miss a lot of cues in the environment. Anger is a very interesting emotion. It enhances risk tolerance. It enhances impulsive behavior, so you're less likely to think about the consequences of your action, and there's sort of this impulse to act. And in social situations, there is often attribution of hostility. So if you're angry and someone cuts you off in traffic, you'd be more likely to assume they're doing it on purpose as opposed to just that they're a clueless driver. Okay. So emotions also have, obviously, the more visible effects on behavior. I'm not going to talk about those as much here. These are obviously very critical for game behavior, for game characters, because you want your characters to express emotion. And a lot of work has been done in this area that's in affective computing that's directly relevant for game design. But what I'll be focusing on is the emotion effects on cognition. Okay, so let me say a few words about affective computing. And let me just start by showing you a little clip. Actually, let me start with a different slide. I forgot which slide went first. So affective computing is a broad area of interdisciplinary research that basically has to do with exploring how you can introduce emotion into machines, how you can model emotion in machines, and how you can recognize human emotion by machines and express emotion. It was the term was coined by Ross Picard from the MIT Media Lab, and if you haven't seen this book already, if you're at all interested in affective gaming, this book is definitely a must, because it gives you the basic background for what the techniques are, what the field of affective computing is about, and you can kind of go from there towards affective gaming. Okay, so let me show you a couple of clips. This is work by Cynthia Brazell, also from the MIT Media Lab, and this is her robot, Kismet. And what's interesting about Kismet is that he understands the prosodic qualities of speech, not the content, and you will see his emotional reaction in terms of what he does with his eyes, his eyebrows, his mouth, and his ears. And I hope you can hear some of this.
Could be loud.
Thank you.
Appropriate. No. No.
That was Cynthia.
No, thank you.
Okay. So that lady that went in there quickly in and out, that was Cynthia Brazell, and she's been doing some very interesting work with robotic emotion expression. Just to quickly show you on a very different side, this is a software agent Max that's being developed, that was developed at University of Bielefeld by Christian Becker and colleagues. And again, it just I'll just show you a really quick clip just so you can see a different type of agent. Okay. Oops. I wanted you to see the gesture. Now, this may not look like much when you're comparing it with the snazzy characters you see in your games. What you have to remember here is that his face consists of individual muscles that can actually be controlled, that are directly controlled by the different emotions that are coming from a dynamic real-time architecture that's actually generating those emotions in real-time in reaction to what the person is saying and doing. So if you look at the complexity, there's just a lot under the hood, and that's the kind of and that allows you to have very general and generalizable behavior in your game characters, and that's the kind of complexity that we're striving for in affective gaming. And of course, you can make the characters look more snazzy. This one is not necessarily someone you'd want to play with, but it's a state of the art in terms of affective agent research. Okay, so affective computing includes emotion sensing and recognition through a variety of sensors from multiple modalities. For example, you can sense arousal through galvanic skin response, heart rate monitoring, various kinds of other sensors. It also includes generation of affective behaviors in machines. So you can generate emotional facial expression. You can generate emotional speech. So you have agents speaking with different intonations so that you know what they're likely to be feeling. And, of course, affect-induced behavior variations in robots. So they choose different behavior depending on how they're feeling. It also includes computational models of emotion. So you have, as I already mentioned, you have the emotion generation through cognitive appraisal, you have emotion effects on cognition and behavior, and you have affective user models, where you're actually constructing a model of how the user is likely to be behaving and what kinds of things trigger what emotions. Oops, sorry. Excuse me. And then you, of course, put it all together in cognitive affective architectures that then drive the agent or the game character behavior. Okay, so the key thing, just to highlight, so you have different examples. You've seen Agent Max, you've seen Robot Kismet. This is another agent called Greta. And affective modeling is really a key to the controlling the behavior and the expressive behavior of all of these agents. So it's really a core aspect of affective computing, which is why it's important in affective gaming as well. Okay, so the methods and techniques from affective computing that are relevant for game design, of course, sensing and recognition of players' emotions so that you can do adaptive gaming. This is especially important in serious games. So it's important in any kind of games because you want to make sure the player doesn't get bored or doesn't get overloaded, so you can kind of change the game structure to keep the arousal and the workload and the frustration level at an optimum. You can also use emotions for game control, and there's some people who are playing with that idea, so that you have some kind of an EMG headset, and depending on your state, you can actually control some aspects of the game with your concentration, and there's some interesting work going on out in California in that. Expression of emotion in game characters is, of course, important. You can get more realistic and more believable characters, and you can get much more interesting social interactions that way. I already mentioned the models of emotion in game characters. They allow you to generate more complex and more autonomous behavior. You don't have to pre-program everything. You can just say, okay, if he's in that state, he's likely to be, say, if the character's anxious, he's more likely to be threat-focused, And you say that, and all the more interesting behavior and behavioral variations then follow. You don't have to pre-program or have a different rule for all these different explicit situations. You can get more socially and affectively realistic behavior, I already mentioned that, and you can get adaptive behavior, which is also more interesting. The agent can adapt to the player and to other agents, again, making for a much more interesting narrative. The affective user models are also critical because once you want the game, you want the games to be adapting to the user. And in order to do that, the game has to know who the user is, what makes them bored, what makes them frustrated, what makes them excited. So that's also very, very important. There's also some interesting work in affective game evaluation. So people are, yep.
What are the key differences between the two types of models?
I'm sorry, between what? Which models? The affective models and the...
Models of emotional game characters and the user model.
Oh, okay. The biggest difference is in affective user modeling, you're actually acquiring the model. So you have to have a lot of learning techniques, and you actually have to try to extract some patterns between, this is what the user does, this is the emotion they're likely to be in, this is what they're going to do as a result of being in that emotion. So in terms of the structure, you're right. I mean, once you structure it, you have attention, you have situation assessment, some kind of a sequence. But it's how you get the model. So in affective user modeling and user modeling in general, the emphasis is really on the learning algorithms.
But in terms of the model, one you know and one you believe.
When you know and when you believe?
If the character is modeling itself, it knows what its emotion is because it produced it in some way. But if you're looking at the user, mm-hmm. you have a belief, some probability, some representation.
So there's a lot more uncertainty.
That's
That is a difference, and that comes down to the learning stuff. Is that you have to constantly be adapting it, and you have to constantly. There is a much more uncertainty there, obviously, and I mean there's probabilistic reasoning in both of them. But that's the biggest difference, really. Yeah, we can talk more about that. That's a good question. Okay, so this is what I'm going to focus on in the remainder of this talk. Are there any other questions before I go on? Okay. Okay, so affective agent architectures. Basically, what you'd like to do is you'd like to take the processes we talked about, the emotion generation and the emotion effects, and kind of lump them in this agent architecture that will then control the agent behavior. So it'll enable the characters to react to the evolving situation of the game. It'll react to other players in the game, and it'll also react to other agents in the game, and of course to the player state and behavior. And it'll do that in a more, in a dynamic, real-time manner, which is going to make the game more engaging. I'll get to how you can actually talk about some techniques that you can use to actually influence the character's behavior depending on their mood. And again, you get a lot of variability that way, which otherwise would be difficult to get. You also, of course, in agent architectures are also important because they allow you to, they're the basis for supporting generating affective expressions. And it's an efficient way of generating the variety of visible manifestations. We're not going to talk about that today, but that's another reason for having an architecture. Okay, so how hard is this? Well, it depends on the game complexity and the game type, obviously, which emotions are necessary. If you're talking about a first-person shooter game, you don't need that many emotions. If you're talking about some kind of a complex social game, like maybe some of the later versions of Sims, then you need to go beyond kind of the basic fear and anger, or joy, I guess, too. What features of the game context are available to trigger the emotion? And this is a key thing. Like in any kind of agent modeling, you have to come up with a repertoire of what's the set of stimuli you need them to react to, and of course define the set of behaviors, the repertoire of behaviors. Simple games, again, may not need that much. But when you get to the more sophisticated games, this is where you're getting to very much sort of state-of-the-art of affective modeling, where people are just now exploring how to model the more complex social emotions, like pride and jealousy, guilt, shame, those kinds of emotions. So again, there's a huge potential in gaming to explore these issues, and the affective modeling and affective computing is directly relevant for that. So let me talk about the two processes that I've already been hinting at, the emotion generation through appraisal, and then the effects of emotion on cognition and behavior. So in terms of the computational tasks, it looks fairly simple. You know, on the one hand, you can say, okay, what's the big deal? You know, have a bunch of stimuli, you map them to a bunch of emotions. True, for some games, for some situations, that indeed is not a big deal, and you could probably have five rules and it would do it. But it gets more complicated because, as I said before, you have internal and external stimuli. They can be real and imagined, past, present, future. There are you have to decide if you're going to do the mapping directly or have some intermediate steps in the mapping, which, of course, also introduces some complexity. How complex are the stimuli? Are the stimuli, you know, a bouncing ball that hits a target, or are the stimuli some kind of a complex interaction which you then have to parse to decide, is this, in fact, a good thing or a bad thing, which, of course, depends on the character's goals and their beliefs. So it can get quite complicated, again, depending on the environment. You have to make choices about what mental constructs are required. What do you need to explicitly represent? The character's goals, their history, how much of their individual history do you need to represent? What kind of complexity of planning do you need to be doing? So again, depending on the complexity of the game and the character, it can get quite hairy. So these are the stimuli, some of the attributes of the stimuli. These are some of the tasks that have to be done. So basically, the basic one is the emotion to stimulus mapping. What stimulus triggers what emotion? How do you calculate the intensity? If the intensity is on a scale of 0 to 1, am I happy at 0.9 or am I happy at 0.2? What determines what that intensity is? What's the nature of that mapping process? What are the stages? What's the degree of variability in those stages? How do you integrate multiple emotion? What if some situation has aspects that make you happy and aspects that make you sad? What comes out at the end? Are you half happy, half sad? If so, how do you behave? Because, you know, the sadness makes you want to run away. The happiness makes you want to run towards the situation. What do you do? So there's a lot of subtlety that has a lot of subtle issues that have to be addressed. And there's, of course, the dynamics of the emotion over time. Are you kind of like a very temperamental person, so you spike up quickly and you come down quickly, or is your character maybe kind of a very sort of a long fuse character with a very gradual onset? Yep. No, and that's a really good point. You know what? Let's not go into it. No, but that's a really excellent. There are. I mean, anger, for example, unfortunately, the negative emotions tend to be more dominant than the positive. But it really depends on a lot of different things. So then you have your emotion. Well, so if you think of the emotion as an object, what are the attributes of that object? What are the fields? So you obviously have a type. You should have the intensity, because that may make a difference in, say, the expression, because obviously intense anger is expressed in a different way than very subtle anger. But then you may want to represent all these other things. What caused it? Which direction should the emotion be? How should the emotion be directed? Because I'm sure you've had the experience where you're in a social situation and you're angry at one person but not at another. So, how do you express that? You have to have some kind of a directionality there. So, again, there are a lot of decisions that have to be made about how you're going to represent these things. So, couple choices, just to kind of give you an idea. You can have a black box model where you basically just go from the stimulus to the emotion. It's simple but clunky, and it doesn't generalize. So you have your classical kind of rule-based brittle behavior. Or you can have process models where you have some kind of a model of the underlying process, which is more difficult to build at the beginning, but it's easier to augment and it generalizes more easily, and you don't have as much of a brittleness problem. So, black box model. Character gains points, he's happy, he loses points, he's sad, he's outsmarted, he's angry. And that may be all you need. That's perfectly fine. And then you put some snazzy emotion expression on it and you're done. But let's say the character is ridiculed and you don't have a rule for that. So this is where it's nicer to think more in terms of modeling the underlying processes. So let me just tell you a little bit about what some of that might look like. So going back to our cognitive appraisal, here we have the stimulus, here we have the emotions, and here we have the cognitive appraisal process. One of the approaches that's being used now, it's called the componential model of emotion. introduces a layer of domain-independent variables that extract some information from the domain and then map the vector onto the emotion space. So some of the, and I'll go more into that in a minute, but some of the examples of what's extracted is novelty. Is this a new stimulus? Valence? Is this good or bad? Is this relevant to my goal? And is it congruent with my goals? So, you know, is this going to help me with my goals? Who's responsible for it? Who's the agent that's responsible for it? What can I do about it? And then there are other ones like, so, you know, is this consistent with social norms, with my norms, et cetera? So now instead of just going from, you know, this one direct mapping process, you introduce this extra step. And all your kind of domain-dependent stuff is here, and once you extract it, you don't have to worry about it. So the theory goes. It turns out it's not that simple. But let's just look at a really simple example. So let's say you're camping, and all of a sudden you see this huge grizzly bear coming up from behind a tree. So you're going to evaluate this. It's new. The novelty is high. The valence is very low because you're about to be eaten. You don't want to be eaten, so the goal relevance is high. And the agency, it's other. It's the bear. The outcome probability is high that he will eat you, in fact. And I think I already said that you don't want to be eaten, so the goal congruence is low, urgency is very high, coping potential is very low. Well, it turns out that this configuration of these appraisal variables gives you the emotion of fear. And so here's a way that you can approach modeling emotion. You can extract these appraisal variables, come up with this vector, and map that onto the emotion space. Now, what's interesting about this model is imagine that maybe you were camping, you had a little bit too much to drink, and it turns out it wasn't a grizzly bear after all. It was a friend of yours holding up a picture of a teddy bear. So all of a sudden, just this one variable is now going to change from low to high, because instead of feeling, oh my God, I'm going to be eaten, my coping potential is very low, you're going to decide, I'm going to go and smack my friend, and your coping potential becomes very high. Just changing that one variable will now change this appraisal vector from fear to anger. And that's another nice thing about this approach of modeling the emotions, that you have a very elegant way of very rapidly changing the emotion based on some new incoming data and adapting it to the situation. Okay, so just to kind of recap, so you have this vector of appraisal values. You map them onto some n-dimensional space defined by however many appraisal variables you have here. And then whichever emotion you use, some kind of a distance measure, you can use Euclidean distance, and whichever emotion your vector is closest to, that's the emotion you pick. So far, so good. It seems pretty trivial, right? Unfortunately, it isn't, because the extraction, deciding what those values are, is the nasty part, because you need a lot of domain-dependent knowledge. Because I already mentioned, you know, emotions are triggered when you have a self-relevant situation. So you need to know about the agent's goal structure, you need to know about his beliefs, you need to know about all individual history, and all of that makes this, so this seemingly very simple mapping becomes more complicated because of this domain dependency. Typically, what you need is you need some explicit representations of the current situations, the expectations, the agent's beliefs, values, goals, plans. I already mentioned that. The causal structure of the domain, the agent history, the social context, the cultural context, if that's relevant for your situation. So again, the complexity can become quite high depending on your gaming situation. You need large amounts of domain-specific knowledge. You need complex reasoning. You need some kind of a mechanism to handle uncertainty, because this is obviously a very probabilistic reasoning that's taking place. You need what-if reasoning lots of other stuff. It's typically, this step is implemented in some kind of a symbolic representational formalism. I like to use belief nets, Bayesian belief nets, because they have a nice, they handle uncertainty in a very, very natural way. A lot of people use rules. People use goal procedure hierarchies for representing the goal structure, the plan structure. Some people use semantic nets, your standard AR repertoire of formalisms. So this is...
Also a weighting. In some situations, for example, when you go up or down,
Are there weightings on the appraisal variables? Is that what you're asking? The weightings. There could be depending on personality. That's right.
I mean,
yeah.
If you're dealing with something urgent already, then this particular urgency becomes less important, even though it's urgent.
No, that's you're right. It does get more complicated. I actually had a slide on that mapping too, but I was just trying to. But no, but you're right. And so the point is that you can make something very simple and make it very elegant if you constrain your environment. You know, just like in AI, right? But if you constrain your game appropriately, then you can make this very simple. You can even make this part very simple. But you're right. There is a huge potential for complexity. And as far as the those are good questions. Okay, so let me just finish up talking about modeling emotion effects. So let's look at a quick gaming context. So you have a situation where you have your game-playing character that's supposed to follow this route. There's a supply station here. You can get some potions or wands or what have you. There's a friend here that's somewhere in the route, and then there's an enemy over here. So the tasks are to resupply, ask the friend to cooperate, and then capture the enemy using the supplies that the character got. And then the character gets points awarded for each task. Okay, now his behavior will change depending on the emotion. We talked a minute ago about the affective biases. So if you have a normal state, your standard happy Harry Potter, he'll go along, he'll pick up the magic potions, he'll ask Hagrid to cooperate, and he'll go and capture Voldemort, and he's going to get the maximum number of points. If he's happy, when you're happy, you tend to assume that things will go well. So when he's happy, he might have the bias that will cause him to just forget the supplies because he thinks he's got enough supplies because he's feeling very optimistic. So he will ask Hagrid to cooperate, and he may or may not be able to capture the enemy depending on how many supplies he already had. But he's basically going to lose the point for resupplying because he just decided not to resupply. If he's angry, he won't resupply just because he's too pissed off to deal with it. He will not ask Hagrid to cooperate, but because he doesn't have a friend to help and he doesn't have enough supplies, he won't be able to capture the enemy, so he'll get no points. And if he's anxious, he won't resupply because he won't even notice the supply station because he's too focused on Voldemort. He'll kill Hagrid by mistake because he's going to assume Hagrid's an enemy because he's just kind of in that frame of mind. And of course, when he gets to Voldemort, he won't be able to do anything because he has no supplies and no friends. So the point is that just the changing mood will create these very, very different behavioral outcomes. And let me just tell you one way that this could be done. Again, I'm not going to go into this, but you've got some list of computational tasks that have to be done. This is a one way to think about emotions is to think about them as different modes of processing. And you can think of the emotions as translating into parameters that control the different processing within the different architecture modules. So there are effects on the fundamental processes like the speed and capacity of attention and working memory, as well as a content bias. We already talked about the thread bias, the self bias. There are also effects on long-term memory, which we mentioned. And these influence the higher-level processes. So you get these kinds of changes that we saw in Harry Potter's behavior. So the idea is that this is a methodology that I developed for modeling emotion effects. And the idea is to capture all of these in these parameters that control the fundamental processes, the speed, the capacity, and the content bias, and that these biases will then these high-level effects will then naturally follow once you implement the low-level changes in the parameters. So let me show you how that's done. So you have your individual differences, your emotions. It also models personality traits and other things. You have your cognitive architecture that's doing something, mapping some stimuli, some input into output, and you have a number of parameters that are influencing what happens inside the architecture, and it influences the behavioral output. So depending on the parameter setting and the emotion that's being modeled in terms of those parameters, you either ignore the friend, ask for help, or kill him by mistake. Yep.
It seems like that emotions only have negative effects on gaming. So when there is no emotion, I do my best, And when there is any emotion, either happy or sad, I do either medium or badly, or the NPC does. So as a gamer, I turn off the emotions so that I can do better at the game.
Okay, is that that's the message everyone got, that that emotions are bad?
Well, that's
what I know. I understand why. I totally understand why you're saying it, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that is not the message I want to convey. But you're right. That example was absolutely consistent with that. Okay, yeah. No, emotions are not always bad. In fact, a lot of the biases that the emotions cause, like the threat bias, is a very highly adaptive bias. I actually have a Larson cartoon on that, but I didn't bring it. So if you if you're walking a dark alley and you have a the guy who has the threat bias and detects the danger earlier is the guy who's going to survive. So yeah, I could have generated an example where the threat bias would in fact have caused the character to react faster to a threat and survive. I just happened to choose this one. So yeah, but I'm really glad you brought that up, because I did not intend to do that. But in this particular instance, you're right. Yeah. Okay. So this is what happens. You've got a bunch of you've translated your emotion into some set of parameter values. They influence processing, and then you get a different outcome. So let's just look at this in the context of a particular architecture. This is my cognitive architecture called MAMID. So it consists of a bunch of modules. The attention module basically collects the cues. I've seen the enemy. My resources may or may not be adequate. It goes into situation assessment. This mapping is done via belief nets, by the way. And the situations kind of integrates the cues and captures it into a kind of a global task relevant state. I am able to capture the enemy. It goes into an expectation generation that says, okay, what's going to happen next? So I'm feeling in a positive mood, so I'll successfully capture the enemy, I'll get game points, and I'll win the game. This goes into the affect appraiser, which generates some emotions, positive valence, high happiness, low anxiety. This is fed into the goal manager, game points, I need to gain more points. And I will choose the action to accomplish that, in this case, to capture the enemy. So this is a very, very simplified version of the architecture. There's actually some parallelism going on, and all of the previous constructs are available to all of the subsequent modules, but I won't go into it. I'm just showing it to you to show you what an agent architecture might look like and what kinds of modules it has. Yep. This is an example architecture. It happens to be from a system that I built, but it's similar to architectures that can be used to deal with these kinds of problems. This gives you, because it gives you the attention module, it gives you the sort of situation assessment module that allows you to build an overall picture of what's going on. The goal manager allows you to choose what you should do next, and then the affect appraiser allows you to generate the emotion. So, okay. My system actually was not built in a game context at all, although it could be applicable. My system is a domain-independent architecture that's been instantiated in two different domains now. And the purpose of my system is to explore how you can model affective biases. So, but I'm showing this to you now because, number one, it includes the affect appraiser module, and number two, it gives you a sense of this kind of data flow model of what happens in a cognitive agent architecture. Yep. Yeah. People are starting to put more emotion in game characters. I'm not aware of any games, any commercially available games that are out there. There was at the IVA in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago, I know there were a couple of papers that were talking about putting emotion into game characters, but it's an area I think that's just starting to rev up a little bit, but as far as I know, there's certainly nothing commercially available. Okay, so just looking at this in a little bit more detail. So you have your emotion states and traits. You can also model personality with this methodology. So I'll just wind up with that really quickly. So here's some personality traits. Here's some emotions. these map into parameters, and the architecture that I have has two kinds of parameters, processing and structural. As the name implies, the processing influences the dynamic processing. The structural actually influences the architecture topology. I'll just go through this quickly. And so the structural ones influence the architecture topology, the data flow among the modules, and the long-term memory. The processing ones influence speed and capacity and the content bias. So here you have your architecture, and the parameters act on the architecture. So let me show you a quick example of how threat bias would be modeled. So you have a particular trait, it's low stability, low emotional stability, predisposes towards negative emotions, so you'd get this bias right here. Then you'd get preferential processing of threatening stimuli in the cue selection and also in the interpretive process. So you're more likely to, to process high threatening cues, and you're more likely to assume that an ambiguous situation is threatening. Yeah?
Can you go back a slide? So on your traits, are those, why don't you have the big five there?
I have a subset of the big five, and I also stuck in aggressive. I basically combined two personality traits from two personality models, the Big Five and the Giant Three. And the reason I did that is because in the initial implementation, I'm sorry?
And the mean was four. Five.
What? Oh, the mean, oh, sorry, sorry, yeah. I was thinking mean, emotion, never mind. I'm aware of those, but there was a reason for that because of the first domain.
So stability is that neurotic?
Exactly, yeah. Aggressiveness is from Ising's Giant 3. It's kind of roughly psychoticism, but it's not good to use psychoticism in some presentations, and it correlates with aggressiveness. So, it's a combination. This really isn't a big deal. I mean, the traits, again, are mapped onto parameters, so you can choose whatever traits you want, and those are just the ones that I happen to choose. It is, but it wasn't for this particular domain. Let me take this up later because I want to get through that last slide. That's a good question. I can talk to you later. So you have your preferential processing of threatening stimuli, which means that you're going to get more threatening constructs are rated more highly in the attention module, and you're going to process those, and then threatening situations are going to be more likely selected from the situation assessment, and it's just going to propagate down and cause the kinds of biases that I talked about earlier when Harry Potter decided to do whatever he decided to do. So in terms of how this is modeled, in Mammoth, this is actually very simple. Basically, the parameter values are calculated by weighted linear combinations of the various factors. These are some of the factors that go into the threat attribute of each cue, and then the threat along with some other attributes contributes to the cue rank, and then of course the cue rank determines whether it's selected or not, and this applies to all of the constructs everywhere. So let me just close up really quickly. So the idea is that future games should recognize and adapt to players' emotions. They should be able to understand the players' affective profiles. Just to increase the affective realism of the game characters and the overall game experience. Affect-focused game design. We're starting to talk about affect-focused game design, where you really take the emotion and the affective considerations as a central focus for the game design, for all aspects of the game design and through the whole process. And so you think about emotion modeling in game characters, affective user modeling, and, of course, emotion recognition and expression. I wrote a paper this past spring about the notion that we should really start thinking about developing affective game engines. We have all sorts of game engines that allow character definition, environment definition, make it easy to do the simulation of behavior. It'd be nice if we started having engines that would actually support these kinds of efforts and give you the semantic primitives and some of the kind of infrastructure that would make it easy for you to model emotions in game characters. There is a website that Jos Brokens and I have put together called affectivegaming.org, which is in a state of transition, but it has some useful information. And if you're interested in finding out more about this topic, I urge you to go check it out. Okay, thank you.